I know you guys are excited, but you got to calm down. Okay, let's get started here. Before we jump into this, let me just get a show of hands. How many of you have seen some version of this lecture by me online before? Okay, about half of you. All right. So today I thought I'd mix things up, and I'm going to give the pro-Keynesian case. Not really. I'm going to go sit on the other lecture. Okay, that helps me. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to try to leave more time at the end for questions because I just said it on Judge Napolitano's class, and I saw that was the interesting give and take, and it seems like that keeps the audience alive also because he goes into the crowd and calls on people and terrifies them. So that's another reason everyone stays alert. So I'll do that. But let me go through the basics. The reason I shy away from them, I'm too afraid to just do the straight out, like calling for questions like during the thing, because when I first started teaching, I would do that, and then if the student would say something that was totally wrong, like one time I allowed the students to present, and I thought that'd be a way to integrate them into the classroom, and they'd all come in and get a topic and come up and give a five-minute summary, and I thought that would be the way for them to learn the material, and then takes the load off me a little bit. You know, I sort of outsource the teaching, and I still get the paycheck. You know how that works. But this one kid got up, and I guess if he sees this YouTube, he might be embarrassed, but he got up there and explained to everyone that there was this guy, Frederick Bastiat, who wrote a thing trying to argue for tariffs in order to protect candle makers. And he was he was against free trade. And so he went and sat down, and I had to kind of say, no, it's the exact, everything he said, put a negative sign in front of it. And so that was I decided I'm just going to lecture from now on and let kids come to me in office hours. Okay, but like I say, I'll try to keep this on the shorter side and leave more time at the end for Q&A, but without leaving those of you who haven't seen this yet behind. So I'll hit the main points. Okay, so the first thing I want to make sure, I mean, this is just classic. This is hilarious. I mean, this was so good that it even ended up on Fox News, this episode. I mean, that's how easy it is to grasp the problem here. You don't need to be a subtle economist or an expert in the Austrian school to see why this was funny. So just to refresh your memory, or for those of you who are from Europe, just to make sure you understand what happened, President Obama was elected in 2008. And it was considered to be a historic election for various reasons. And he came in and people were hailing him as the next FDR. And they meant that as a compliment. And and so they came in and you know, many of us were saying, yeah, he is. Or well, let's hope he's not. But so he came in. And so his new economic team that was headed by Christina Romer and some others. So they came in, and I think Jared Bernstein. And they came in and they produced this document justifying what is now referred to as the Obama stimulus package. And it was like the numbers changed in retrospect, but it was quoted as like about $700 billion, or even more, $700, $800 billion package. Now, just so you know, that wasn't all new spending. There actually were a lot of tax cuts that were in there. But it was going to increase the deficit the way they score this thing, because they were going to reduce the revenue that otherwise would have come in, and they were going to increase spending. And so this document that the Romer team produced was going to justify why this was necessary. So at the time, remember, so you know, the fall of 2008 was when there was the financial crisis. Federal Reserve came in, took over AIG, and then in November is when they, or sorry, October, they passed TARP, and things just kept getting worse and worse, economically speaking. So everybody knew, okay, we're in a big recession here, and it's getting worse. And so this is January, a few years into it, with this new president at the helm. And so this is from that document that they produced, the Romer-led, you know, this had her name on the cover and so forth. Okay, and so they were warning. So look, you got to look at the timeline here. So this was in early 2009 when this thing came out. So at the time, the actual unemployment rate was 7% and change, but it was increasing, right? Because we were clearly entering a bad recession, and the unemployment rate kept getting higher and higher. And so they said that we need to pass this thing, this $700 billion, whatever it was, stimulus package, because they're saying, look, if we do pass it, because we all know that the problem in a recession is that aggregate demand is insufficient and we need more aggregate demand. If we do pass it, unemployment will continue to tick upward, but it'll taper off a little bit below 8% and then come down. So we won't breach 8% unemployment. And, you know, and that's what will happen if we pass this thing. They said, but suppose, you know, the Republican fools block this thing, or the public for some reason doesn't get behind it, and the Democrats chicken out. Suppose we don't pass this that big deficit spending package. Well, they're saying in the absence of it, without the recovery plan, unemployment might actually break 9%. And can you imagine how horrible that would be? And that scared everybody. And they said, by all means, let's pass this thing, because we can't imagine. Again, when they're discussing this thing, unemployment is 7% and change. And they're saying, you're telling me unemployment might break 9%? I mean, that's really high. Like, you'd have to go back to the recession in the early 80s for that kind of number. And that seemed inconceivable to a lot of people. So, okay, by all means, go ahead and pass this thing. So they did pass it. And then what happened in practice? With the so-called recovery plan, actual unemployment got higher than 10%. Okay? And you can see how high it was as of May 2011. It was still, you know, if you squint really hard, you can kind of see that that is higher than that. All right? So it's a little bit of a gap there in what they thought was going to happen. So, again, if for those of you who saw my time on the battlefield talk a couple days ago, or maybe it was yesterday, when I was walking through the medical analogy, this is what I had in mind. And I was saying, you know, if you had doctors arguing over something, and somebody took a patient and he said, hey, I'm going to give him this thing, this new treatment, because if we do nothing, if we just sit here on our hands, he's going to get to be pretty, you know, pretty worse off. And then, but if we apply this medicine, then we expect this condition to improve. And then they gave it to him, and the patient ended up worse than the doctor had been warning would happen if they did nothing. That prima facie would be evidence that, wait a minute, maybe this isn't medicine. Now, again, you could argue that, well, it's a special case or whatever, and that's exactly what the Keynesians did in response to this. And Christina Romer wrote an op-ed later, you know, to New York Times or someplace like that, saying, well, the problem here was we were off in our baseline forecast, right? They're saying the economy at this point right here was worse than any of us realized. So it's even, you know, more important, and it was even a relief or a good thing that we passed that package. Because had we not done so, then unemployment in reality, you know, would have been up here somewhere, right? So the way they're saying that this is how many jobs they saved or created in their projection, they're saying that really did happen. It's just the gap would have been up here. So they're saying had we done nothing, actually unemployment and its baseline trajectory would have gone up to 13, 14%. And thank goodness we only held it to 10%. So that was their argument. So that's not crazy. I mean, that could be true, and you could come up with comparable things that the Austrians might say in some circumstance, but clearly this should be an embarrassing episode, and again, it's prima facie evidence that the Austrians and other critics of the stimulus package were right, and yet, what I said, like I said in that medical analogy, what you clearly couldn't do is point to this as evidence that the stimulus worked. The most you would do if you were an honest Keynesian is say, yeah, this by itself would be a strike against us, but we have theoretical reasons for believing blah, blah, blah. And yet the Keynesians routinely, because I think the CBO or somebody came out with some study years later to say, oh, turns out after careful observation, the stimulus was a good idea. And they counted all the jobs the stimulus saved or created, but people, critics of that report, you know, and it had this sort of scientific aura about it that, hey, this isn't just conjecture. You know, this is after the fact, looking back after the data are all in. But again, you're comparing it to what otherwise would have happened. So it's you can't after the fact look back in time and say, well, what if we hadn't done the stimulus and observe what would have happened? And yet that's really the metric that they were using, because clearly it's the unemployment rate got a lot worse once this thing kicked in you know, just looking at the observations. So clearly on a naive level, this thing hurt the economies. And so that's, but like I say, they were after the fact pointing to the CBO studies and so forth, trying to say, see, this thing, just looking at the observation without any a priori theory here, look at the facts, this thing reported that it worked. And the critics pointed out the way those models worked is they had Keynesian assumptions built into them. And just naively said, well, because the government spent X, Y, and Z and created these jobs, those were, you know, the unemployment situation was better than it otherwise would have been, just assuming that those jobs were created at no expense of jobs elsewhere. Okay, let's talk a little bit about my good friend Paul Krugman. So he has been running victory laps, and the way he deals with this embarrassing Keynesian episode is to say that, hey, I predicted this, right? That, so don't be going around saying all Keynesianisms were wrong. When that Romer Report study came out in January of 2009, on my blog of the New York Times and in op-eds, I was warning the Democrats that this thing is inadequate and that Republicans and conservatives are going to point to this failure as proof that it was a mistake. And so you guys are crazy. You need to have a bigger stimulus package. This is inadequate. It's on the right track, but it's not big enough. Okay, so let's evaluate that particular claim. Okay, so it is true. He's not completely making that up. If you go back to his blog again in January 2009 when he's commenting on this Romer report, it is true that he's saying it's not big enough, and he specifically warns. He said, look, there's going to be unemployment in 2010 is going to be high enough that I'm telling you guys, if you just pass this thing as is in its current form, the Republicans are going to come back in those midterm elections and, you know, just trounce you guys because it's going to be construed as that this was a failure and the stimulus didn't work. However, if you really carefully read his arguments, we'll read this and I'll explain what I mean. He was using the unemployment figures in the Romer report itself to make his case. All right, so let me make sure you get why this is significant. The Romer report was clearly screwed up, right? In reality, actual unemployment got a full point higher than they were warning was the worst case scenario if we had a laissez-faire outcome. All right, so clearly the Romer report was screwed up, and the way Romer dealt with it is just to say, yeah, our baseline forecast was wrong, but we were right that stimulus per se helps. And so Krugman is trying to say, I told you that unemployment was going to be too high and people were going to point to this as a failure. But what I'm saying is he was not, his point in making that case was not to say the Romer report's baseline is way off and that actual unemployment is going to be like 14% if we do nothing. And so even with the helpful stimulus, it's going to be limited to 10%. That's not what Krugman was saying. Let me just back up a second here. What he was saying is looking at the Romer report itself, he was saying, what are you guys thinking? Look at what you have here. In 2010, according to your own estimates, unemployment's still going to be over 7.5%. And he's saying, so why in the world are you, even if on your own terms, if this turns out exactly as you're predicting, the Republicans are going to crucify you guys if unemployment is still above 7.5%. And we know that, I mean, today, right now, people are still mad at President Obama and the Republicans still bash him and say the economy's awful when the unemployment rate is in that range, right? So that's what Krugman's point was. He was not saying that their baseline forecast is way off, and that's his resurrection of the case. So that's a subtle point, but I just wanted to clarify that. So he's being at best misleading when he's making it sound like he totally predicted the course of unemployment, and so therefore Keynesian models per se shouldn't be embarrassed by this episode. One last little footnote to that. Don't misunderstand me. It's hard to pin down exactly what did he think the baseline was, because he does have an offhand remark saying something like, and I think that their baseline forecasts are rosy as well. But for him, that was just icing on the cake. His main point was that looking at their own numbers, their own projections, unemployment in 2010 is still high enough that the Republicans are going to kill you guys politically. Okay, and then also other Keynesians at the time, like Mark Zandi he's a very popular forecaster, and he was making projections like in November about how bad the economy was going to be and why we needed a stimulus. And also, if you look at his projections at the time, he had no idea of how bad things were going to be. And the way he covered himself afterward was again to say, well, we just didn't realize how bad the situation was, and all the more reason it was a good thing that this stimulus kicked in. And if only it had been as high as I was asking for, we could have cushioned the blow even more. All right, so again, when Krugman is trying to run victory laps, if you read him a lot, you know that's his big trump card in all. He keeps claiming that the Keynesian models predicted things much better than what he calls the Austerians or the Austrians. And so I'm pointing out that on something pretty important, namely unemployment, they failed. Let me also just have a brief digression. Some of you may know that I had a price inflation bet with this guy, David R. Henderson, who was also, he is a big proponent of cutting government spending. and we just had a disagreement about what price inflation was going to be, and we put it on our respective blog to try to be fun for the readers. And so I lost that bet. Price inflation was not as high as I thought it was going to be, and so I paid him and everything. And Brad DeLong picked up on that, and he's jumping up and down saying, ah, see, austerity doesn't work, which again, is it'd be like if he and Krugman had a debate, a bet about something, and one of them lost, and I said, see, Keynesianism is wrong. Right, that's what it would be analogous to. And so I said on my blog, I said something like, well, hang on. So yeah, I did lose that price inflation, but why is it that all of a sudden my whole worldview is supposed to be thrown out the window because I was wrong on price inflation when Christina Romer was wrong about unemployment in her forecast? How come Krugman doesn't throw out Keynesianism? And he actually said on his blog, I'm not inventing words, he actually said, because some predictions matter more than others. All right, and so meaning that if you're wrong on your prediction of unemployment, that's not as big a deal. So if I wanted to be a jerk, I could say, oh, Paul Krugman admits purchasing power of money is more important than jobs. But I won't say that because I'm not a jerk. Okay, let me mention something else. So this is a new argument that I've worked in case you saw the old lecture. This is something new because I just realized Krugman's perfidy. All right, so Krugman's botched deflation call. So I just caught this fairly recently. This was back in February 2010, where I came across this blog post where he's walking through why it is, the context of this post, he's walking through why it is that he and other mainstream economists don't look at the headline CPI number. Because as I'm sure you guys know, what they often talk about is the headline CPI number, but with energy and food costs removed. Right? And so people, that's an obvious joke line to say, oh yeah, sure, things are great unless you have to go buy energy or food. But then but if you put that in, then your things are awful. And so Krugman was explaining why they look at these different types of measures. And the two actually that he said are the best are what's called these trimmed mean measures. And we don't have to worry. On the next slide, I'll show you exactly what they were. But his point is he's at the time in February 2010, he shows this chart, which I'll put up in a second. And he says that these preferred measures, that his preferred measures of price inflation show an ongoing process of disinflation. So disinflation means it's still positive inflation, but it's falling. That could, in not too long, turn into outright deflation. And then he puts this thing up. So I apologize that this might not translate well, but I was just capturing it from his blog post. So this says alternate inflation rates percent change over previous years. So when he was writing this in February 2010, This is what the chart looked like. So you can see it looked like it was falling off a cliff. And so you can see it had gotten down to 1% year over year. So year over year means you look at the monthly number and then you look at it from the prior 12 months and you're seeing the percent change. So it's a moving average. It's not that you just look at the yearly average. It's that you're looking at month to month compared to 12 months previously. So when he's writing this, he's looking at this continued fall and he said, it's going to keep falling, this continued disinflation, right? It's lower and lower rates of positive price inflation. He said that could, in the not-too-distant future, turn into outright deflation. So that would be meaning crossing the zero point, so that at some point he thought in the near future that if you looked at the current prices as gauged by these median and trimmed is the measure he was using, that it would be a negative number, that the level of that would be lower than it had been the 12 months prior. So that was his prediction. And so then after showing that chart, he ends the blog post by saying, Japan, here we come. So in Japan, there had been actual price deflation for more than a decade. Okay. So clearly Krugman is saying, I think there's going to be deflation at this point pretty soon. Okay, so then what actually happened? Well, I made this chart. So I used the same, it was from the Federal Reserve Bank. And their price inflation measures, these were the two things he was looking at. And I went and got the chart, several years later in 2013 is when I grabbed this chart. And you can see, and I put in this black line. So you can see how this is what the picture looked like when the previous chart I showed you. So this is when Krugman said it's going to hit continued price disinflation and then we're going to have outright deflation. And he said, Japan, here we come. And you can see right after he said that, it turned around and zoomed way up to pre-recession levels. All right, so clearly the trend that Krugman thought was going to occur did not occur. It turned around quite rapidly just a few months after he made that call. And you could say, oh, okay, fine, Bob. You're just cherry-picking everybody. If you post three blogs a day, you're going to say something wrong eventually. And so if you're a Krugman fanatic like you are, Murphy, you're going to be able to catch him at some point, but this isn't reflecting his overall worldview or something. But actually it was. And this is from what he said, Krugman blog post July 5th, 2013, in a rare moment of candor for him. He says, I think many of us used to believe that sustained high unemployment would lead to substantial, perhaps accelerating deflation, and that this would push policymakers to do something useful. It's now clear, however, that the relationship between inflation and unemployment flattens out at low inflation rates. Okay? So, again, this is what he's saying, is that because they used to think that if you had high unemployment, right, there can't be much demand, then you were going to have, in his own words, substantial and perhaps accelerating deflation. And then he realizes, oh, wait, but actually it turns out we were wrong. So he's not hanging up his keyboard, right? He's not apologizing to the world for, yeah, I was totally wrong. I thought there was going to be accelerating deflation when clearly there wasn't. It turned around right when he said that. And, you know, has he altered his policy prescriptions one iota, even though his policy prescriptions are based on this worldview that he's now admitting, oh, wait, that wasn't quite right. So he's allowed to tweak his particular thing, even though he said that, you know, oh yeah, unemployment doesn't matter, some predictions matter more than others. Well, he had in mind inflation predictions, meaning price inflation. And so on his own criterion then, he was totally wrong. So it's, one way I like to phrase it is, what basically, since he's saying, no, we call this the ISLM model, perfectly predicted everything, whereas these Austrians are crazy and they don't have the guts to admit that their model was totally wrong and they don't go back to their drawing board and rethink their policies. Implicitly, what he's saying is if there had been price changes anywhere from negative infinity up to about 8%, he would have said, I called that, right? But then if it's maybe 8% or higher, then the Austrians could have conceivably been right. And that's basically the way he's judging this thing. So that's a pretty big margin for error on his part. Because what I'm trying to get at is suppose price inflation had actually been negative 3%. It's not that Krugman would have said, oh, that kind of surprises me. He would have said, I told you guys. I said perhaps accelerating deflation. So it's what I'm saying is without outright hyperinflation, he's saying, yep, I called it. Okay. What about this idea that the government and the Fed have done too little or too late? Because this is a constant theme you get from the Keynesian perspective, that they will admit that, okay, yes, there was historically large budget deficit under President Obama, but again, it was too little. That there would have been a second Great Depression had they not done that, and that's why we're only stuck with the Great Recession. So it's, again, they can, even though in the face of what seems to be their recommended policies, even though things are awful, this is clearly a terrible economy, and the government is certainly not doing what the Austrians recommended, nonetheless, Krugman and others like him point to this as evidence of what happens if you listen to the hard money, budget balancing, inflation crazy guys, right? And so their rhetorical ploy is this, always the government in practice doesn't do the extreme proposal of Paul Krugman on his blog post. And so no matter what happens, in other words, if it works, and this is true, I'm not putting words in his mouth. And when was this? I think it was either July, I think it was August of 2009, he had a New York Times op-ed saying something like, big government saved us from another depression. Okay, now that might not be the exact word, but it's the spirit of it. And you can go through and look at that. And he's saying the recession is now officially over because in terms of the official GDP statistics, you know, the GDP had stopped shrinking and then started expanding again in the summer of 2009. And he said, why is it? And he said, because of big government. That's literally his phrase. All right, so just look at the rhetorical tricks there. In order to explain why the recession ended, he said, because of big government. In order to explain, hey, how come the economy is still so bad? And he's saying, because of these unprecedented austerity measures put in place by the crazy Republicans listening to Mises. All right, so no matter what happens, he can explain it. If you're talking about, oh, a good economy, it's because of big government. If you're talking about a sluggish economy, it's because of this austere government that's being, meat axe is being taken to it. Okay, so what about this claim that, you know, the Fed and the government have done, okay, they've done some measures, but just really not enough to get the job done. Well, looking at the monetary base, I mean, so the idea that Ben Bernanke, if only he wasn't so conservative, have just been willing to expand a little bit. I think this is, if you, again, if you squint really hard, you see how it goes up a little bit over there? So this is, what is this? This is the monetary base that is one of the measures of the quantity of money. This is bank reserves on deposit with the Fed and also in their vaults. And I think it's also, currency in circulation. All right, but it does not include checking account balances. So when the Fed buys assets, those transactions automatically increase the monetary base. So this is largely a reflection of the fact that the Fed expanded its balance sheet greatly since the fall of 2008. So you can see that Bernanke added more to the monetary base than all of his predecessors put together times two. All right, so that's, that's a fancy way of me saying he tripled the monetary base. So and this goes also for the market monetarist, that's the name now being given to the school of thought that's represented by guys like Scott Sumner. Scott Sumner says that the reason we're in a slump right now is that Bernanke has had the tightest monetary policy since Herbert Hoover. All right, and, I could understand saying Ben Bernanke has had the craziest, loosest monetary policy in U.S. history, but it's not enough. I mean, that kind of makes sense to me. I disagree, but to describe this and say Ben Bernanke has the tightest monetary policy since Herbert Hoover, and that's why the economy is in a slump right now, and that is Sumner's number one explanation. Yeah, he thinks that the housing bust had some contributing effects, but for him, the fundamental reason the U.S. economy has been in a slump is that the Fed has been too tight. And again, just my position is if you see a chart like this, something's wrong with your vocabulary, your terminology, if that's what's coming out of your approach to the world. Okay, then as far as the deficit, you could say, okay, what about from the Keynesian perspective, is the federal budget deficit too big or too low, or is it? What do we make of the claim that, yeah, they did a little bit in 2009, and that was just enough to prevent a great recession, but it wasn't enough to really spare us the agonies of this slump, and that's why we're mired in this thing that's been dragging on for years. Well, one way to assess that is to look at, so this is the federal budget surplus or deficit as a percent of GDP. All right, I could have rigged it even more if I put it in absolute dollar terms, but even as a percent of GDP, and you can see, it went down to 10%, so since it's negative, that means it was a deficit. So the budget deficit hit 10% of GDP, which you have to go all the way back to the middle of World War II to get a government deficit that big. So this kind of ties in with what I was saying about the standard Keynesian or monetarist explanations of the Great Depression, where they'll say something like, oh yeah, the reason that 29 stock market crash festered into the Great Depression is that Herbert Hoover didn't do anything. Or the Milton Friedman's approach saying, oh yeah, the reason is that the Fed didn't intervene and stop all those bank panics. But again, that seems odd to attribute this unprecedented calamity to inaction when, by everyone's account, that inaction was at least more active than all their predecessors. So by the same token, it's a bit weird to say the reason we're still in what clearly is the worst economic world catastrophe since the Great Depression, it's weird to say it's because the government didn't run a big enough deficit, which is what Krugman and his people who think like him are saying, when you can see they ran the biggest budget deficit since then. And again, it's just note the irony that we have to say the last time the government used your recommended medicine this much was also the last time the patient was this sick. And that, and you're right, they ran a bigger deficit back then, and coincidentally, that was also when the economy was even worse than it is now. So, you almost get the sense that government spending is bad for the economy. If you didn't know any better, you might think that the government taking resources away from the private sector is not a way to promote recovery. But yet, the Keynesians looking at this just say, no, it's a good thing that, that we had this big deficit, and that's why the economy was doing so healthy in the middle of the World War II years. And it's a good thing we did that, because otherwise the economy would have been worse than it already was. So yes, if you go in theoretically thinking government spending necessarily helps create jobs when you're in a position of aggregate demand, you're going to be able to see that, even though, like I say, prima facie, on the face of it, even if you didn't know anything about economic theory, if you just wanted to let the numbers speak for themselves, and you ran these charts. The government running big deficits occurs when the economy is already in a slump. And let me just, again, try to be fair here. A Keynesian might say, well, wait a minute. Of course you're going to see deficits get bad during these gray bars, which are the slumps, because that's when tax revenues fall, and that's when all the safety net programs kick in. You know, more people need food stamps and stuff like that. And that's when governments, especially since World War II, are going to engage in counter-cyclical policy. So, of course, you're going to see a correlation between a bad economy and big government deficit spending, because that's what you would expect to see. Just like, again, using the hospital analogy, you would expect to see people with cancer getting chemotherapy. You wouldn't want to conclude, therefore, chemotherapy causes cancer, right? Same thing here. And that's why, though, that Romer episode to me is so significant, because there what happened is they made projections. They told us how bad they thought the economy was. Then they got their so-called medicine, and all of a sudden the economy was worse than they realized. So that's showing you that it's not merely an issue of confusing correlation with causation, that under their own rubric, it looked like the patient got sicker after the application of what they were claiming the medicine was. Okay, another way of seeing just how bad the deficit spending has been. So again, what's my point here is that, remember, the standard Keynesian line is, yes, it is true that the Obama, or under Bush, first of all, but then more so under Obama, increased the government deficit, but it was inadequate to deal with this problem. So one way of me trying to show you an alternate way of me trying to show you that claim is a bit hard to maintain is look at what happened to the government debt as a share of GDP. So this is from the CBO's own figures. So this is, I went to update this slide. So first of all, make sure you get the main point is you can see how much the increase happened. So this is in fact, and then after this dotted line is the projections. So as of this was the slide that I used last year for Mises U for this talk. So it must have been, it was probably from the May 2012 CBO, but it's conceivable that this could have been a year old at the time. So 2011 at the latest. And you can see, again, far higher. You have to go back to the immediate post-war era to see when the government had pushed the debt up to this level. Again, relative to the size of the economy. If you looked at just absolute numbers in terms of trillions of dollars, it wouldn't even be close. All right, and then you can see again that the projections too. So let me now just doing a little aside because I think it's funny, not like Daily Show funny, but Economist funny. So I went to update the slide because I was like, okay, well, you know, I used this last year at Mises U. Let me get the latest slide. And before I show it to you, I got to explain something to you. A little inside baseball here. So the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, they're actually not terrible economists. It's just they're in a very awkward position, and this is why you should never go work for the government, because what they have to do, these baseline projections, you might say, oh, well, the baseline projection, look at the debt's going to get under control really fast here. But this builds in all the, it assumes that the current law is going to remain in force. So they have things like within Medicare, for example, they have what's called the doc fix. And so the legislation always assumes that they're going to drastically cut the payments they give to medical care providers in order to contain costs in the Medicare program, and maybe Medicaid too. I don't remember what the relationship there is. But it's very politically unpopular. It's the kind of thing where, you know, if they cut the payments that much, a lot of doctors would just say, well, we're not taking Medicare or Medicaid patients because we're not getting paid enough for these services based on what the government. And so it would be political upheaval. And nobody wants to vote for that thing. And so they keep extending the unsustainably high payments to doctors under these programs. So this baseline projection assumes that Congress going forward is all of a sudden going to be able to stand up to the doctors and the people who are not going to get care now because they've cut the payments that much. This also at the time, this was made before the so-called Bush tax cuts expired. So that's another way that this thing worked, just so you guys know how this happened. When the Bush administration put in its infamous tax cuts that the Democrats keep railing against about the handouts to the wealthy, They didn't want, when the CBO scored those, they didn't want the number to be too high in terms of the cost to the Treasury. Because the way they do this stuff, they say, if the government cuts taxes, that's going to reduce revenue and therefore increase the deficit relative to whatever the projected spending level is going to be. And so they didn't want the CBO to score this thing at the time when they were passing this big tax cut. They didn't want it to look too expensive because then the Democrats would get up and give speeches against this irresponsible handout to the rich, this, you know, burning our grandchildren and so on. So they build into the measures the fact that they're going to cut tax rates, but then it's going to sunset. You know, then the tax rates automatically are going to jump back up to the pre, you know, legislation. Oops, I just did something. Let's see. If I can get this up, it's going to be a miracle. Okay, that was almost a disaster. Okay, so they built in, the Republicans built in under Bush, these tax cuts, a sunset provision to contain the cost. And so the CBO then has to, but every time it would come up, they would just keep renewing it, right? Because nobody wants to be voting for a tax increase. So they would keep extending the Bush tax cuts. So in case you're wondering, for those of you who are in the U.S. and you follow those policy debates, that's why, because I asked this at one point. I asked these guys I knew in Washington, and I was saying, how can they get away with keep saying extending the Bush tax cut? Why wouldn't it be the opposite? Why wouldn't it just be this is the status quo now? Because these things have been in place since like 02 or 03, whenever the last tinkering went in. So how can it be that, you know, years later in 2008 or 9, wherever the debates were happening, why are we calling it extending the Bush tax cuts? Why wouldn't it be that the opponents of that are going to be construed as raising taxes above this, how they've been for the last 7 years? And the guy said, well, because the Republicans built it in that way, because they wanted to contain the estimates that were made at the time when it went through. If it were just a permanent thing, then they would be allowed to say this measure will cost us, you know, this many trillion dollars. But if it's just a temporary 4-year deal or whatever the number was, then they can keep it to be under $1 trillion, the cost of this. And I was like, oh, okay. So it was actually the Republicans allowed themselves to be hammered like that, that every time then you went to extend it, it was called extending the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. Okay, so part of what this is was building in the fact that tax rates were going to go back to the pre-Bush tax cut level, even though that had been continually pushed back year after year because nobody wanted to vote for raising taxes, especially once the recession kicked in. So they have what's called an alternative fiscal scenario, and that's where they basically say, and the way they describe it is kind of funny, they said something like, assuming policymakers act as policymakers have acted in the past. Right. In other words, assuming that they actually don't do all these things they keep promising to do. So another way of putting it is to say, this is what Congress promises it will do, but this is what they actually do in practice. All right. And that was how the CBO used to do it. And like I said, I felt bad for them because when they're, you know, given something to score, they have to play the game and pretend that, okay, well, yeah, if you did all this stuff, this is what the outcome would be according to our models. But then they would sort of give a little jab and say, however, you know, we kind of think it would be like this. So that's what this was. So then I, like I said, went this year to update this slide, and I went to the CBO's, the analogous CBO report from May 2013, which would have been comparable to this, just to see how these things changed a little bit. And all I saw was this. They no longer have the alternative fiscal scenario in there. I think this has just got to be the baseline. So the baseline's bad enough. You can see it comes down a little bit, but then they project it to rise because even with them throwing everything they can at the wall, nobody can even come up with numbers that with Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid that the deficit's not going to start rising even as a or the debt's not going to start rising even as a share of GDP. So the point is this is the optimistic scenario now, and they no longer even put the alternative on there. So it's probably to save money, I'm sure. That they don't want to have to come up with two scenarios. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting that they have suppressed this. I also noticed this back in 2008, if you go to FRED, which is the St. Louis Federal Reserve's website, they have all kinds of neat little charts there. And I was showing a chart of excess reserves that went back to 19, I think it started in 1919, and it was from your perspective, it was a flat line on zero, basically, and then and it went, you know, way up depending on when you took the snapshot of that thing, just to show how unprecedented this was. Like I said, it went back to like 1919 or something like that. And so this guy I knew was using that in his PowerPoint and going around town, going to various conventions. He actually would give talks to bankers about this stuff, and I was surprised because he was talking about fraction reserve banking and quoting Rothbard, and I was, you know, saying, they're going to lynch you. And he said, no, they were all amazed after I'd give my talk. None of them had any idea what they were doing, you know, in terms of these are guys who work at commercial banks and, you know, mid-level managers and so forth. And he would give this real fire-breathing denouncement of fractional reserve banking from a Rothbardian perspective, and these people kept inviting him back. Because, again, he was telling me that they had no idea. They'd never even heard this stuff before. So it wasn't that they were taking personal insult at it. They were just like, we're doing that? Is that right? And so, but anyway, he had that chart, and then I told him at one point, I said, you know, that thing's out of date at this point. The excess reserves are like double that because, you know, like a year had gone by. So I said, you should update the chart to look even better. And he couldn't find it. It would only go back to I think 1960 or something like that. And so it looked more impressive to be able to show that zero line or it's close to zero going all the way back to the early 1900s or whenever, soon after the Fed was founded. And so I went to look for it because I just thought, oh, he just doesn't know how to find it. And yeah, he was right. The automatic charting feature, because it looks more authoritative if it comes from the Federal Reserve site itself, because it looks like you're not doctoring the numbers if you do it in Excel or something. And so I tried to get it, and it wasn't there. It would only go back to, like, I think the mid-50s or 61, something like that. And I emailed them to ask, yeah, 6 months ago, back in the fall of 08, I was able to get this data going way back, and now your charting feature doesn't do that. And they wrote back and said, oh, yeah, we've moved that now to the historical archives to save money. And that you can... So the point is, again, call me cynical, I think it was they realized this looks awkward for bloggers to be able to use our own website to generate and show how crazy this is, so let's make it so. Because if you can only go back a few decades, it doesn't have the same rhetorical punch. Okay, what about the success story of World War II? This is going to be, I'll go through this fairly quickly because I think a lot of you may have been in my other lecture where I did talk about this already. So just the context, what am I talking about here? That the Keynesians, one of their biggest trump cards is to say that clearly this idea that we're advancing is not crazy, to say big government spending is how you get out of a depression, is valid because look at the case of World War II. So the problems with that, again, I'll be brief here because I think a lot of you have already heard me make this case this week, is that it treats government spending as equivalent to private spending. And so the way these GDP numbers are calculated, if the government spends $1 million on tanks and bombers, that's counted as part of output just as much as spending the same amount on people spending it in the private sector. What time does this class go to? 45. It goes to 45, right? Okay. So that's one huge thing, and if you missed my other lecture and you want it, you can go look it up. They have all the things, all the PowerPoints. Go look it up, and you'll see the decomposition of the GDP figures, the totals, into their private and government components, and you'll see that private GDP during, like, 1944 was lower than it was during 1933, the depths of the Great Depression. And so that's just showing you, even using the government's own figures, even though there's all kinds of crazy problems with those figures, even on paper with their own statistics, it's showing people in the private sector were getting lower real output of real goods and services from the private sector than during World War II with all this big government spending. It also ignores price controls. This is a kind of a subtle point, but it's important. Bob Higgs brought this to, I think, everyone's attention. I don't think anyone had really made this point before, that the way these GDP figures work, they look at the nominal expenditures. They count up actual dollar expenditures, and then they adjust for what they call the GDP deflator. And so what that basically means is that they take account of price inflation. So let me just give you the intuitive example so you make sure you understand it. This year, let's say people spend $1 trillion total on various things, including the government. So you say, okay, GDP this year is $1 trillion. Then the government doubles the quantity of money. Let's not worry about distributional effects. Next year, people spend $2 trillion on all the stuff the economy produces, even though the same physical quantities of DVDs and cars and everything is produced. So nominal GDP doubled. It went from $1 trillion to $2 trillion, but the prices of everything doubled. So if they had an accurate measure of the price level, like a, you know, a basket of certain goods, of representative goods, and that index doubled, theoretically, they should be able to perfectly account for that. They would say, yeah, nominal GDP doubled, but we have to have a doubling of the price deflator, and so real GDP is still $1 trillion measured in last year's dollars, right? So that's the way they should capture this stuff. So what Higgs pointed out is he said, wait a second, these nominal GDP figures admittedly got huge during the World War II years, but at that time, the Federal Reserve drastically increased the monetary base. They were financing World War II with the printing press. So technically, the Fed would be buying government bonds, and so indirectly creating money out of thin air to give to the government so they could go into the market and buy steel and whatever else they needed for the war effort. And so Higgs was saying, now normally, if the government were cheating that way, you would just see it because prices would be through the roof. You know, you'd see double-digit price inflation year after year, and so those nominal GDP figures would be deflated, so real GDP wouldn't look as impressive as it does in the official statistics. He's saying, but there were price controls, explicit price controls put in place during the war years. And he said, and the GDP statisticians don't even acknowledge that. They don't even account for that at all. And so I emailed him to make sure, because I put this into my book on the Great Depression, and I said, let me make sure I understand you. Are you saying they adjusted, but you don't think they did it well enough, that they were being naive, and that they only deflated the official nominal numbers a little bit when really prices probably would have risen a lot more? And he said, no, I'm saying they didn't adjust for it at all. They just looked at the conventional price level as determined by law at this point and said, that's the price. And since, you know, if the law said prices can only go up 1%, then the fact that spending went up, whatever, 20%, they only deflated that by a 1% increase in the price level, even though had prices been free to move, they would have gone way up. So, I mean, that's just the technical argument to show why those figures are bogus. And so his point is to say, putting aside your methodological objections to GDP accounting in the first place, even so, there's something particularly dubious about the GDP figures that the government puts out for the war years. So you really don't want to use those to try to prove that the economy rebounded because of this massive spending. Okay. So another way of looking at this, again, putting aside this price control issue, even on its own terms, private output fell 55% over 3 years, and government debt during the war increased by a factor of 5. So again, a factor of 5. So what's my point here? As I'm saying, okay, put aside that price control issue. Take the Keynesian case on its own terms. The Keynesians are saying, look at the case of World War II. This shows the efficacy of our plan. Right, we're not hoping for another war. Again, we're just hoping for a fake alien invasion. But again, what their point is, and I just want to, this is such a, I'm dwelling on this because in addition to being economically wrong, it's just so awful that we're in a position where we have to explain that no, blowing up entire cities and just mass murdering people actually isn't good for productivity. Right, that I can't believe we're in this position that I have to be making this case. But since we are, let me make sure I show you another argument here. So what I'm saying is, ignore everything else I said. Even on its own terms, what the Keynesians are saying is the best success story we have to show how big government debt can, you know, jumpstart an economy out of recession or depression is World War II. And I'm saying, okay, let's look at those figures. Let's look at the trade-off involved. Because clearly, even Paul Krugman, I hope, would admit you wouldn't want the government to go into a debt of 4,000% of GDP to create one job, right? We can agree that at some point, even if I conceded it made sense to, or that it worked, that you could run bigger deficits and then create jobs on net, that by itself doesn't prove it's a good idea. Clearly, there's still trade-offs involved. And so what you'd want to look at is to say, well, how much job creation do we get in exchange for a given increase in the debt? And so I'm saying, they themselves tell us the best example of what they have in mind, and I would say it's actually the only example. I've never seen them point to another historical episode where it worked. What they always do is point to episodes like 2009 and say, see, it would have been worse had we not done that. But on the face of it, it's when things got worse. But here is where at least you could see why they might think that the economy recovered, because it didn't seem like the economy was in the Great Depression in 1943 anymore. It seemed like we were all on war rations trying to beat the Nazis. So, but anyway, I'm saying, even on its own term, private output fell 55% over 3 years, and government debt during the war increased by a factor of five. And so if you update those numbers to today, you know, in today's context, you know, would people really be willing, in order, even if it cured unemployment, even if we got rid of this lagging unemployment that we have right now, would households really be willing to see their private consumption? So whatever it is that you consume right now in terms of real goods and services, would you want to see that get cut by more than half over the next 3 years? But in exchange, you would have a lot of government schools and bridges and really well-paved roads and things that the government's spending the money on, and that the national debt, instead of being $14 trillion, is $70 trillion 3 years from now. Right? Would anyone take that bargain if we said, you're right, Paul Krugman has convinced me, Keynesianism does work. Right now, consider your standard of living. 3 years from now, that will be cut in half, and the government official, you know, what we call the national debt, will be $70 trillion. Who's on board? Who wants that? Or do you want to just suffer through this thing? I think most people would say, I don't want any part of that. And I've just given it the best possible case where they're running the deficit and spending the money on good stuff like, you know, schools in Britain. A lot of people say, no, government schools are terrible, but you get what I'm saying. That the things Krugman's saying they should spend the money on as opposed to building tanks and bombers and things that aren't intrinsically useful, I'm saying whatever it is that he thinks the government's going to spend the money on, is anyone going to take that bargain, even if we can see that it would end the Depression? And I think most people would not take that bargain. So again, this is casual pointing to World War II. If you just inspect the argument, it breaks down when you actually take it seriously. Okay, let me quickly touch on this. Now their latest thing is just to say matter-of-factly, and the people have tried austerity in Europe, and it's clearly a failure. So that the, you know, these right-wing deficit hawks have been repudiated so many different ways, and they're just a bunch of apologists for giant corporations in the 1%, and because they're just not scientists. All right. So I don't want to dwell on this too much, but here's something that I think it was Veronique de Rougy compiled. So I'm sorry that it's a little bit distorted there, but I wanted to make it big enough that you could see. So this is this was through 2011. So in some of these, just to warn you, in some of these, if we updated, there might have been actual cuts from this point forward, right? That I couldn't get a version of this chart that was more recent. But the Keynesians were making this case at the time. And the whole reason she compiled this was because she was getting sick of the Keynesians jumping up and down about all this awful austerity in Europe. So this, we're not setting up a straw man here. People at this time were claiming about how horrible it was. And so this is just showing the absolute level of spending. And you can see that, you know, in France, it hadn't actually been cut. In Italy, it had just leveled off. The UK, which was considered a poster child of austerity, again, it was higher. Spain, it actually did go down, but not significantly. And even Greece, which, you know, where it's being pointed to as just the horrors of austerity, as of 2011 at least, you can see it really wasn't this dramatic cut, all right? And so, and when she posted this, I mean, Krugman flipped out and was just, you know, because, again, the audacity of her to put up the actual level of spending when, in his mind, that was a completely misleading figure, and what you needed to do was adjust for the output gap and the rise in social spending programs and all these other things, when you could see why this would irritate him so much, because it's kind of hard to blame what happened in Europe as this failure of major fiscal austerity, when you can see all they did was they slowed the rate of increase, or maybe slightly cut their absolute level of spending. And this is all happening, by the way, of course, look at the years here, when their revenue was collapsing. So their deficits were still huge in this period, and they were just slowing the rate of spending or slightly cutting spending in light of the fact that their debts were mushrooming. And you can also see, too, that a lot of these places increased between 08 and 09 as the Keynesians recommended. And it didn't work. And so then some of them finally came to their senses. And this is a classic progression of how these things work, that the policymakers will initially do what the Keynesians say and increase their budget deficit. It doesn't work. And then after a while, they realize, okay, we can't keep doing this. And so they cut back a little bit. And then the Keynesians point to that and say, well, it's because you cut back and that's why the economy is awful. But if the economy had been fixed in the first place, then they wouldn't have been in that position. Okay, so why don't I stop there and I'll take your questions in the remaining time. Yeah, right there. You talking about in 46 how it fell?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It was on slide 12.
Of this presentation?
Yeah, or this presentation.
This one? That's a guy putting his finger in a dam. This one? Uh-huh. Okay, so that to summarize the question, he said Keynesianism say yada, 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 and I agree, and I think that's right. Okay, so it's in answering the question, I'll try to repeat it so that people hearing this online know what was asked. So one point of just clarification, this particular chart is the budget surplus or deficit from the federal government. So this is showing that the deficit they ran in, I guess this would probably be like 44, my guess is, was more than a quarter of the official GDP. That's how big the budget deficit was. So this is not showing GDP. This is showing the size of government deficit. But it is true. So the question was saying, couldn't Austrians point to the post-war era as an example of, you know, a vindication of their perspective? And I don't know if this is what you had in mind, but let me say that, yeah, a big thing is, and Higgs has been harping on this, and I think a few other people in the Austrian camp, that from 45 to 46... there is a statistical, actually, depression, I would think, that if you looked at the official GDP figures, because the government drastically cut its spending so much since, you know, the war ended from 45 to 46, it looks like there should have been a big depression. And actually, there were a lot of Keynesians who were warning about that, that they were saying as the war was winding down, you know, let's not be foolish if we just, you know, demilitarize and just cut spending naively without worrying about the economic consequences, we're going to go back to the depression. Because they believed that what pulled us out was this massive government spending, and they thought if the government cuts its budget now, we're going to get back into the depression, when that clearly didn't happen. And Higgs points out that from 45 to 46, the increase in private sector GDP was the largest one-year increase that's on the books. I don't want to say the number because I'll get it wrong, but it was a huge increase, something like 40%. Again, don't quote me. But so the increase in just a single year of private output. And so just kind of showing that, yeah, when, you know, again, think about that. Imagine the coincidence. When the government going into the World War II era started massively increasing spending, siphoning all kinds of resources into killing other human beings under the government's control and imposed unprecedented measures bordering on fascism, right? So as bad as the New Deal was, the interventions in the economy were not as bad as they were during the war years itself in terms of the federal government directing the economy. It was clearly at its height during the war years. And so that's when things were awful. And then when they relaxed it, when the government massively cut spending, when it released the price controls, you know, freed up the price controls, allowed much more of private sector control, that's when all of a sudden you see this big surge in private sector output and a genuine return of prosperity. So again, all of this, like you say, accords with a free market Austrian perspective, and it's really only statistical illusions, I would say, that even gives rise to this notion that, oh, the war got us out of the depression. That's crazy. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, good. So the question is, you know, well, hang on. Shouldn't the Austrians have been predicting a bad recession in 46 because the government had been controlling all those resources? You know, isn't that like a standard boom-bust cycle? So I guess I give two reasons. One is that, I mean, there technically could have been a slight statistical recession. I mean, I'm sure, according to certain measures, maybe unemployment did go up. But my point was there was not this massive failure of the economy and the return to the Depression the way some Keynesians had been predicting. But beyond that, the Austrians also would have just said in general that if the government massively cuts spending and lifts a bunch of top-down, you know, controls bordering on outright fascism, that would be good for the economy. So you had two things going on at the same time, because it's true that the Fed was inflating a lot and then cut back when the war ended. So I would say that yeah, you might have had a standard boom-bust cycle, but it was superimposed upon a cycle of the government drastically expanding during the war to unprecedented levels in U.S. history and then drastically shrinking. And so put the two things together, and actually the post-war era was fine. Okay, well, one quick one. How would you know? This is the federal budget deficit. You wouldn't be able to... Oh, the gray bars, okay. Yeah, so it's, yeah, statistically, yeah, the GDP did shrink. Can I just answer, because we're over time? Let me just... So the question is, this term austerity, should we be using it? I mean... You're right. It's a loaded term, especially because a lot of what is described as austerity is in Europe, where there were big cuts in social programs in order to fund bailout packages to rescue big bankers. And that's what was being labeled austerity. So in one sense, you want to say, I don't want to have anything to do with that, because clearly most Austrian libertarians would say, no, you wouldn't bail out big bankers. And yeah, I don't like welfare spending, but certainly... If the government's going to spend money, you know, it makes more sense to give money to genuinely poor people than to give money to rich bankers. That's just crazy. So you're right in terms of that is a loaded term and a trap. But on the other hand, I mean, I don't mind as long as I clarify that what I mean by austerity is cutting spending. Because, I mean, most households, when they're on an austerity budget, that doesn't mean they're going to increase the amount that they rob their neighbors. It means they're going to spend less. And so I want to say by the same token, austerity shouldn't mean they raise taxes. It should mean drastic cuts in spending. Okay, let me stop there. Thanks, guys.